Yes, it's in two parts. The opening question was that we say that we're against all idea of leadership, but the questioner then says, but we went on to talk about government. Well, let me deal with these two things separately. The SPGB's attitude towards leadership is that until workers have got into the habit of thinking for themselves and making their own decisions, they are not going to get socialism. In fact, they are not going to get their interests looked after. That it isn't a question of whether the leader in whom they put trust is genuine, sincere, and all the rest of it, or whether he isn't. It's the workers who have got to make the final decisions. It's got to be the workers who decide they want socialism. It's got to be the workers who, having achieved, got control of political power and introduced socialism, they are the people who are going to have to run it. And only people who have got taken the responsibility of thinking these things out for themselves can do these jobs. Now, that's our attitude on leadership. But then the questioner goes on to say, we talked about government. Well, this is something that you see that Comrade Baltrop dealt with. We didn't say that we are going to have a government which is going to introduce socialism. Comrade Baltrop emphasized, as the SPGB always does, that it's got to be a socialist working class who makes these decisions. The socialist working class has got to dispossess the capitalist class, and to do this, they've got to get control of the machinery of government, but not in order to put in a different kind of government. They have got to, having got power and cleared the way for socialism, they then got to take on the great responsibility of running the world on a socialist basis. So it seems to me that the questioner has not really understood what case the SPGB is putting on these two things. He understands the first part about not having leadership, but he doesn't understand what the SPGB is saying about government and the separate question, the need to gain control of the machinery of government. The socialist idea is that socialism is going to be a non-coercive system of society in which people will cooperate voluntarily to carry on production and distribution, not being directed to do so by somebody whom he would call the government. The questioner, in fact, has got to look more deeply into this to understand what the party's case is on it.
Question, to repeat it, is in brief, I think, and it did start so promisingly, that we have had 70 years of capitalist parties. The questioner then speaks of Parliament being set free to be used for the establishment of socialism, and says the trouble is that MPs are bound to their parties, that they are, to use the common phrase, lobby fodder, that if they could vote in secret, then many of the problems would be solved, they would be freed. And he refers to the bribery of voters in the 19th century. As far as that last matter is concerned, I'm not sure that the difference today is so very considerable. I don't always know what happens in town areas. I live in a country area. But I do see that the great attraction of the Conservative Party in the country area that I live in is that it gives a handsomer tea and a bigger coach outing to the electorate every year. Not quite the same as pickaxe handles, but I'm sure that the encouraging effect is there. But would it make any difference if members of Parliament could vote in secret? Well, you see, what you are looking at is the members of Parliament and not the electorate. What would members of Parliament do if they could vote in secret? Let us have a look, if you like, at some particular MP. Say Fred Higgins, who has just been elected for Chipping Sudbury as a Tory MP, and we know, as the questioner says, that he is going to trot in and out of the division lobbies, and indeed Fred Higgins's dog would do almost as well. And the questioner says, surely if Fred Higgins could vote without his party leaders knowing what he was up to, then this would make everything different. But in fact, Fred Higgins went to Parliament on the condition that he supported capitalism. He didn't go to Parliament as a socialist. He may have gone as a Labour MP, he may have gone as a Tory, he may have gone as perhaps our questioner would like him to, as an independent. But he hasn't gone as a socialist. He has not been sent there by an electorate that wants the capitalist system abolished. Now, if he is sent there by such an electorate, there is no problem whether his vote is secret or is public. He has gone there with a mandate for one thing only. If he hasn't, it doesn't make any difference whether he votes at the behest of the whips or according to his own wishes, because in fact they're likely to be identical. Look, this is another version of the question. Would it be better if there were honest men instead of crooks in Parliament? Well, there are many honest men in Parliament, people who go there hoping that their love of fair play will become a byword. And what do? They do exactly the same things as the MPs whose names are a byword for similarity to Horatio Bottomley. They do exactly the same. You see, this kind of thing is an irrelevant, and to keep is an irrelevance. And to keep to this point of the honesty of members of Parliament, if you like, there have been many honest and charming and decent people in Parliament who did exactly the same as if they'd been rogues. I have known, say, a Communist Party leader who was a most charming and honest and decent fellow, and he told the same whopping and self-contradictory lies as if he'd been a rogue like most other Communist Party leaders. Well, you see, it's a question not of the intention of the individual MP. It's a question of the people who elect him. Unless they are people who want to be represented in Parliament, who are in fact delegating him consciously to bring about a change in society, then his intentions don't really matter. And if his own personal preferences are supplanted by the wishes of a party, then there is no great difference either. If I can just finish by giving one example over this, so there's one other thing I want to say. A few years ago, there was an outstanding example of members of Parliament acting as lobby fodder over the possible creation of the third London airport at Stansted, when a lot of members of the Labour Party said, we are not going to stand for this, we're going to vote against it. And there was a Labour government in power. And Wilson said, go on, get out of it, into the lobby, quick. And they did. They trotted into the lobby. Their consciences disappeared. But see what these people wanted. They didn't want any fundamental change. All they wanted was an airport to be put somewhere else and not at Stansted. And if they'd had it somewhere else, the process would have been repeated. In short, there was really no difference worth talking about. It was a difference of individual preference, but it was not a difference of attitudes towards society. There is one other important thing to be added about this. The questioner may believe that an advantage to society would be gained by secrecy. We say that no advantage is ever gained by secrecy. This is the stock in trade of leaders. And although he can see this possible advantage that members of Parliament wouldn't now be going in and out at the behest of their leaders there, what about the advantage, or otherwise, to the working class of having members of Parliament without the faintest idea of how they were voting? The representatives you put there, who thus become irresponsible to you. And in fact, an important aspect of the Socialist Party's case during our lifetime has been that we are against secrecy in politics in any respect whatever. We have no secret meetings, we have no secret votes. Everything that we do is on show before the public, as it were. This is something which no other political party can claim. And this is something which, if the alternative is presented to us as a virtue, sorry, we say, secrecy can never be a virtue and can never be to the interests of the working class.
If we say it can be achieved with the ballot box, what's your answer to Chile? Mary and his government.
If we say it can be achieved through the ballot box,
see, what he's saying is that they're trying to put it in Chile for the ballot box in other ways.
Well, three questions which I'll repeat as I go along. The first one, and I'll answer them briefly because of the passage of time. The first one is that since I pointed out that it isn't true that there are no differences between the Tory and the Labour Party, the questioner doesn't understand why we don't exercise a preference for the Labour Party. Well, the answer is very simply that to recognise that there are differences between them is not to imply that one must therefore have a preference. Both do stand for the running of the capitalist system. We do not want the capitalist system, and therefore it is quite pointless for us to say we would rather have capitalism run by Labour than by the Conservative Party. If you want examples of the kind of thing that we mean by differences, for example, when it comes to housing and the money allocated to housing, and if you recall, I spoke of the differences as being largely financial differences. The Conservative Party's housing policies will be directed more towards the building of private houses than council houses. The Labour Party's housing policies will be the opposite, directed more towards the building of council houses than private ones. But these are not differences which are worth our or anybody else's considering. Overall, both parties are incapable of solving the housing problem. Why, therefore, should we support them on such a ground as that, even though it is a difference? Why, in fact, should we support any party which stands for capitalism when you consider it's not just a case of the capitalist system in itself, because it's the capitalist system, but because of the consequences of the capitalist system? Look at this. We're opposed to capitalism because of its effects, not because of itself. When a person becomes a socialist, he begins by objecting to wars, to unemployment, to the poverty which in greater or lesser degree all working people live with, to all the problems consequent on poverty, like housing and illness and poor education, to the fact that a working class life is a bloody rotten life. This is where people start from. And from that point, then they come to the word capitalism. And if you see those things as the consequences of capitalism, regardless of who it's administered by, then what's the point of a preference? The second question is, pardon?
I feel socialism, as I understand it, can be established, and I do want it established, but as I understand it, then during that time, if we do care about the state of the working people, then we, until we are able to bring socialism in, then one party, if one party is better, then we should.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. The questioner puts a supplementary question. He says, well, he too wants socialism. What I have said is humanitarian material, but until socialism can be realized, in the meantime, we must strive, I think you're saying, to make things better.
I'd say that if you care for the, which I thought you do, then during the period up until socialism,
then you should choose the party that will care most for the working class. Look, very briefly, first, our appeal is not and has never been a humanitarian one. We stand for, and what I was speaking about just now as the effects of capitalism, the interests, the material interests of the working class. When I say that war is an effect of capitalism, the condemnation of war is not a humanitarian one. The condemnation of war is a fact, pure and simple kind of thing. It is not in the interests of the working class to get killed in millions. It is not in the interests of the working class to have insufficient food, clothing, and shelter. This is not humanitarianism. This is cold and hard fact. Now, as for the meantime, until we get socialism, well, this is a question which has been put to us again and again during our lifetime. What you must see is that if everybody takes this standpoint, the meantime is infinite. It never ends, because people will support capitalism and contribute to its sustenance for the meantime and of course socialism never becomes possible. And unfortunately, you see, during our lifetime, not hundreds, but many, many thousands of people have put precisely this question to us. They've said, look, I am a socialist, but I want something done while we're waiting for socialism. If every one of those people had said, I am a socialist, I'll come in with you, the meantime would have ended long ago. We'd have had socialism long ago. The second question, capitalism can't work for the working class. Well, what about Sweden and Denmark? Well, I don't know anything about Sweden and Denmark except that they are capitalist countries. Not very long ago, I was talking to someone from Norway who laughed and said, you know what they say about the Swedes in Norway, that they're the most regimented people on earth. But, in fact, this is something which we've been told continually. In Sweden, they have state capitalism. The means of production are owned in the same way as they are elsewhere. The standard of living of the working class is possibly a little bit higher through administration by the state, but the position of the worker in Sweden is fundamentally exactly the same as the position of the worker anywhere else, and likewise in Denmark too. Third, the use of the ballot box, as exemplified in Chile. The questioner says, if socialism can be obtained by electoral means, what about Chile? Implying, I think, that people tried in Chile to establish socialism and this was got rid of. Well, this simply isn't true. What people voted for in Chile was a communist politician who sought to establish state capitalism, had he been successful. Of course, he was overthrown, but all the same, had he not been overthrown, then the people of Chile, even with a majority government for poor old Allende, would have been in the same position as people living in communist regimes elsewhere. They would have been living in state capitalism, many of them working for state enterprises instead of private ones, and finding there was absolutely no difference. Don't confuse state capitalism with socialism. There is absolutely no similarity.
To repeat the points made by the questioner, first, the questioner says, we say that the SPGB has an attitude towards reforms. We don't support the idea of trying to reform capitalism. So what do we say about the Amalgamated Engineering Union and the fight they put up against the Industrial Relations Act? He then went on to say, why don't people pull together? And in general, what have we got to say about this situation? Well, of course, it raises a whole lot of questions. But remember this, that as Comrade Baltrop's already pointed out, if you are going in for a reformist program, you are going to extend the meantime forever, and you are not going to solve your problems. This is the framework in which you're looking at this about reforms. Take this idea, I'm coming back in a sense to what the last question about reforms and making choices. In 1906, one of the leading people, a trade union official incidentally, in forming the Labour Party, made a statement. He said, look, don't worry about socialism, let's get on with practical problems. And the practical problems then were, they were named, one was housing. Has the housing problem been solved? Nearly 70 years ago. Keir Hardie said that one of the first things they were going to do was to deal with war and disarmament. Been dealt with? Not at all. I mean, the destructive capacity of weapons of war now is about 1,000 times what it was at the time that Keir Hardie said, let's be practical, let's deal with these problems one by one. This is the sort of reforming you're up against. They were going to deal with unemployment. Unemployment hasn't been dealt with in spite of what I said earlier about Mr. Bill Simpson thinking that with the help of Maynard Keynes they've solved the unemployment problem. Of course they haven't solved it. They were going to, by the way, another thing, they were going to solve the workers' problems with nationalisation, and one of the things they were going to do, they were going to say that if you get nationalisation, the workers will get higher pay and there won't be any strikes. Well, I ask you, I mean, there are hundreds and hundreds of strikes. You could take a position last year where nearly all the nationalised industries were on strike together. You ask the workers in the nationalised industries what they think about nationalisation. They know it hasn't solved any problem. And this is, you've got to take this reformist business as a whole. We say to the working class, look, your problems need that you get rid of capitalism. We were saying this when we were formed in 1904. We said to them, look, if you don't decide to get rid of capitalism, your problems will not be solved. Well, don't remember this. We were not the only people in this. We had the opponents, like David Shackleton and the others, and Keir Hardie, who were saying, look, not only if you give us Labour Party, not only will we improve capitalism and solve its problem, but we will also give you the socialism that you want at the end of the road. I would point out something. If any of you go to trade union conferences now, or read Labour Party literature now, references to socialism have always disappeared. You can meet members of the Labour Party now who don't know what we're talking about when we talk about socialism. Years ago, I mean, I can remember back before the war, there were lots of members of the Labour Party who at least did know something about what socialism meant. And they would argue then, yes, we will accept your idea of socialism, it will be got through the Labour Party. You never hear Labour Party people talking like this now. That is the whole background of this Labour Party business. Now, when you come to a particular issue, like the Industrial Relations Act, you've got to get a few things in mind. Conrad Bartrop has dealt with the position that power is political. Power rests with the people who control the machinery of government and the armed forces. And nothing exemplifies this more clearly than this business of the Industrial Relations Act. There may be other reasons. One of the major reasons why the Tories wanted the Industrial Relations Act, and I remind any of you who've got any illusions on it wasn't the employers who wanted it. When Barbara Castle issued her In Place of Strife, the TUC and the Confederation of British Industries issued a joint statement saying they did not want any major changes in the trade union law. That was the position. If you want the answer, the Tories thought they saw, and it's happened previously, they thought they saw a chance of winning an election by, to use their language, standing up to the trade unions. This was a very large issue in having the Industrial Relations Act at all. And, of course, Harold Wilson was thinking the same. It's been placed on record by conversation between Victor Feather, I think it was Cecil King, that Victor Feather said at that time that what Wilson was after was what the Tories were after. They both thought that they could win an election by standing up to the trade union. You've got to remember, most workers are not in trade unions, and the Tory party estimates, I know that is an exaggeration, that 40% of trade unionists vote Tory. So it isn't a... See, when the questioner says, why don't people all stand together? Well, because the working class do not stand together, and there is only one issue on which they could ever possibly stand together, and that's to have socialism and get rid of capitalism. But the workers aren't like that. They've got all sorts of subsidiary things in their mind. Now, about legislation to alter trade union law, come back to what Comrade Baltrop said about where power resides. In, was it last year, an issue arose about the five jailed dockers. And there were people who didn't really understand the situation who said, look, the trade union Congress threatened to have a one-day strike, and the government got the wind up, and the government immediately released the dockers. This is, of course, nonsense. It was the government were trying to get the dockers out before the TUC even decided to hold their one day, not of strikes, but what they called protests and demonstrations. The government did not want those dockers in jail. It was a mistake, by as has happened repeatedly through capitalist history, some bullet-headed judge gives a silly decision and lands the government in difficulties, and they saw this with the dockers. The government solicitor rushed round to the prison as soon as they were in and said, we're applying to get you out. And as I say, it was a race whether they could get them out before the TUC could hold their meeting. But all right, people could, you might say, and people could say, yes, you know, but if the government hadn't released them, the TUC would have threatened the government. They'd said, look, if you don't release these people from prison, we will have a day of protest and demonstration. In fact, we may get them as... The records show the most that they've got on any occasion, including the AEU in the last 3 years, when they've had political strikes, is about 1.25 million. They're saying to the government, look, if you don't release these dockers, we'll get 1.25 million workers to take a day off work and lose their pay on it, by the way. Have you noticed there are a number of trade unionists who've been in jail since last December? The pickets. Why didn't the AEU and the TUC and all the other unions say, you let those people out or we'll strike? Here you've got a different situation. This was through the normal process of law. Incidentally, they were not jailed under the Industrial Relations Act, but under common law. The government was saying the law is going to take its course and we're not going to let those people out. So what happened? On the 10th of December, a certain event was announced. In London, where I lived, there were posters on the wall. I'm asking a rhetorical question. How many of you people who are members of trade unions came out on strike on the 10th of December, which was the day announced, all out to get the pickets out of jail? According to the press, the number of people who came out was about 20,000. But I mean, even if it had been a million, the government still would not have given way on that issue. They wanted them in. And what has happened since? The AU has been mentioned. The AU have got some sponsored members in Parliament. What have they been doing? They were raising the question in Parliament, and strange as it may seem, they were claiming that these people being in jail, it wasn't only AU MPs, other MPs, they're saying, you know, it was contrary to trade union law. But what else have they been doing? This last week, they've gone cap in hand to the Home Secretary, and they haven't said to him, look, if you don't let these people out, we're going to call all the workers out on strike, because they know very well the workers would not come. I mean, they might get a million out for a day or two, and the TUC doesn't want it. They've been going on to the Home Secretary, cap in hand, and saying, will you please reduce these sentences? We think they're excessive. And what is this a lesson? The lesson of this is, it is political power, the people who control the state machine, who dominate society. Trade unions could cause an enormous amount of trouble to the capitalist class, but if it is a vital issue for the capitalist class, the people who've got control of the machinery of government, or can get control of it, will dominate and will win on an issue like this. I would throw on one other word, I mean, merely rather a side issue. The history of the trade union movement is not nearly as bad as some people think that it is. I would say that at least half the time that the trade unions have been in existence, which is now a century and three quarters, at least half the activities of the trade unions have been completely illegal. What has happened? Wise, astute workers in trade unions with experience have learned in the past how to test the situation. They don't try to confront a government because that means confronting the people who've got real power. What they do, they wait till they act unobtrusively, or they wait till the atmosphere changes, or wait till the capitalist class are busy with something else, like when the capitalists are busy at war, and the trade unions then ignore the law and do it with impunity. But we would be failing in our duty if we didn't say to the workers all the time, look, recognise where power exists. Trade unions have, if they really work together on an issue, they've got power to, so to speak, to hamper capitalism and cause a lot of hardship to themselves and everybody else. Incidentally, the people who are least affected by it are the capitalists themselves. But if it is a question of getting power, you've got to get control of the machinery of government, and you can't with impunity defy the people who've got it. Again, look at one other thing. I mustn't speak too long on this. Look at what's happened to all the amendments of the Trade Union Act. In the existence of the SPGB, there was the 1906 Act. Incidentally, under the Taft-Vale decision, which was remedied in 1906, the fines imposed on unions, if you take into account the fact that prices are now about 10 times what they were then, the fines imposed on unions were ever so much greater than they are now. And what did the trade unions do? What had they to do? They went along to the Liberal Party and did a deal with the Liberals. They said, look, you change the law, then you can count on us advising our members to vote Liberal, which they did. 1913, they did it again over the political levy. 1927, when the Tories introduced the 1927 Trade Disputes Act, after the general strike, by the way, don't get the idea, so to speak, you can have a general strike and get the capitalists to give way, as it were. You got the thing the other way around. They had a general strike. It was defeated. The capitalist class then introduced the 1927 Act, and in spite of all the protests, the demands for strikes, the meetings, and all the rest of it, they had to wait till 1946 before they got it repealed. And they did it again, another deal with a capitalist party, this time the Labour Party. And now they've done another deal. They didn't get rid of the Industrial Relations Act by threatening the capitalist class. They fixed up this compact. they went to Wilson, they were doing it before, while the Tories were still in office, they said, look, let's form a social compact. You give us certain things, including the repeal of the Industrial Relations Act, we'll give you the backing of the trade union movement, we'll tell our members to vote Labour, we'll give you a lot of money, and you realise what one of these things is. One of these things is the tacit acceptance of even the Tories' phase three wages policy. It was announced last week. Michael Foot, the new left winger who's going to change the nature of society, the pay board told a couple of unions that they cannot have the increases that they have already agreed with the employer, and the employer in fact has got to take the money back again. This is announced by Michael Foot. This is part of the compact that the trade unions have entered into. They have said to the government, well, you repeal the trade union, the Industrial Relations Act for us, we'll give you the backing of the workers, and it is a comprehensive thing. They've taken the lot together, and part of it is they are telling the great mass of the workers, not the miners, they're telling the great mass of the workers, moderate your wage claims. This is the reality of capitalism.
Well, summarise the question. The questioner says, bearing in mind that the establishment of socialism requires a majority of the working class on an international scale, what would our policy or our strategy be if we found ourselves with just over 50% of the seats, I think you said, and 100% of the electorate?
First of all, I'm talking about on an insurance scale.
Yes. If we had a bare majority in Parliament. Yes. Yep. If we had a bare majority of socialist delegates in Parliament, what would we do towards the rest of the world? Well, the supposition, which is not a new one to us, I'd say two things about it. The first one is that this supposition always excludes anything similar having happened in the rest of the world. And because this is a supposition which is quite groundless, because whenever a social movement of strength takes place in one part of the world having particularly become what one modern philosopher calls a global village, then it's the concomitant changes of consciousness take place very quickly indeed in other parts of the world. In other words, the supposition that there would be a socialist majority, whether substantial or slight, in one part of the world and nothing much resembling it elsewhere, is one which we don't entertain. The second one is, what would we do in such a hypothetical position? And this is a question which, in fact, we don't answer, not because we haven't got an answer, but because the implications of our having an answer are ones which are contrary to the implications of socialism. Look, this is similar to a question which we are often asked, tell us what socialism would be like. And people often press us about this. If you can describe the socialist world in detail, then you've got a winner. People won't support you because they don't know what it's going to be like. Well, of course, this is a very plausible argument until you see the part of the statement that's been missed out. Because if we were to start saying to people, this is what socialism will be like, we, all the few hundred of us, what's the bit we've missed out? What's the other half of the sentence? Whether you like it or not, we have decided. And so, however attractive and plausible this, it is not any business of ours to say it. That sort of decision is going to be made by the people who find themselves with socialism, what kind of world they want it to be like. And similarly with this question here, what would we do if we had in Britain, how many, 20 million socialists or something like that, a bare majority, to sustain a bare majority in Parliament? It is impossible for us, the few hundred of us, to announce what the 20 million socialists who haven't yet come into being would decide in substantially changed circumstances. And this is why questions like this It's not a question of not being able to project an answer. It is a question that it would be irrelevant and insolent for us to try to answer them. This, in fact, is the question that wants the leadership answer. It wants us to say, look, this is what you are going to do. And this is the thing which we don't say. We say, on the contrary, when we have conscious socialists, they will decide what they are going to do. Chairman has suggested 2 minutes, 2 minutes to 9:20, that we might answer this briefly and make it also the occasion for the concluding remarks, so that you may all go home happy or dissatisfied or whatever your frame of mind may be. The questioner says, does not the bringing into being of socialism presuppose a change in the nature of human beings? Well, there are so many things that can be said about this. The first one is that changes in the nature of human beings are taking place constantly. What the questioner is really supposing is that the nature of human beings is a fixed entity. We do not find this. It is not something which can be supported. On the contrary, we find that throughout human history, not merely ancient history, but history within our times, within our lifetimes, human nature has continually changed. Human views and aspirations have continually changed. Second, of course, it is not human nature that we seek to change. What I have just said has been an observation on what takes place anyway. What we seek to change is consciousness, and that too changes all the time. And during the Socialist Party's lifetime, people's consciousness also have changed. I would say this to you. There are, I said, a few hundred members of the Socialist Party, not really 200. Things aren't as bad as that. There are, in fact, very large numbers of people who will come along to us, as a questioner down here said, I am a socialist, yes, I like the kind of prospect that you talk about, but it's a long way off. Well, when somebody talks to us like this, this means he is one of the many who say to us, well, look, the trouble is, I'm looking over my shoulder. When you show me a lot of other people who are going that way too, I will come along with them as well. And the world is full of people looking over their shoulders. And I would say that the world is full of people who are not by any means such a long way from consciousness of the need for and the realizability of socialism as you may think. This has nothing at all to do with human nature, though insofar as the nature of man comes into it, I would say this, that if you have in mind that ideas are all that matter, well, indeed, if we waited for the realization of an idea, we might wait a very long time. But on the contrary, the socialism in itself means the expression of the material interests, and I said this earlier, of people. And it is material interests which drive people to become socialists. It's when people perceive not an idea, but the world around them, that they begin to look at the possibilities of changing this. Certainly, the Socialist Party has a function in helping to create that consciousness, but capitalism is part of that function too. It's from capitalism, as well as primarily, in fact, more than anything else, which creates socialists. Now, finally, and to close up, this meeting has been about the powers of government. What we have endeavoured to do in this meeting has been to speak about political power and to make the single point, besides talking about just how that power operates, to make the single point that given the capitalist organisation of society, then all power rests in the hands of those who control the political machinery. Wanting to change society, we must therefore look at a realistic way of changing society. We have many alternative ways put to us of confronting that power, of trying to undermine it, of trying to do something else with it. But the only realistic method of changing it is, first of all, to see that that power is sustained by the willingness of the majority of people. And that willingness has therefore got to change to a rejection of it. And that can only be achieved through consciousness. And second, having seen that consciousness grow in the majority of people, having found that the majority of people now say no to the capitalist system. We don't want it anymore. We want to get rid of it and establish socialism. How is it to be done? And there is only one realistic and valid way, and that is for them to go to the point where the whole entity of capitalism is sustained and backed and fortified, and that is to the state. Once you take hold of that, then the capitalist class, whether it be large or small, has no more power. This is where its power resides. If you look at this in a simple, everyday kind of way, there used to be, years ago, I haven't heard it for a long time now, a sort of direct actionist, anarchist byword, what we will do is lock the bosses out of the factories. A most redundant phrase, because the bosses are never in the factories. They are sensible people. They keep as far away from them as they possibly can. But the bosses nevertheless are still their factories. What magic works here? How do they manage to obtain that they are still their factories? Through the state. Because the state sustains a